Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the March 28th Planning Board meeting. We have a hard cutoff at 2:30, but hopefully, and I think we'll be able to accomplish the entire agenda. So we normally start with approval of the minutes, but apparently there's been a glitch in the system, and you'll see they are not reproduced in your package. So we're going to defer approval of the minutes from the last meeting, February 28 meeting, to next month. And next month we'll have the meeting minutes for this meeting and the February meeting. So hopefully the board members will review those and we can approve them both next month. So next, we'll go to the city attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the board. Today's meeting of the planning board will be conducted in a hybrid format with members of the board physically present in the commission chambers at Miami Beach City Hall and applicants, staff, and members of the public appearing either in person or virtually via Zoom. To participate virtually today, members of the public may dial 1-877-853-5257 and enter the webinar ID, which is 861-4342-6327#, or log into the Zoom app and enter the webinar ID, which, again, is 861-4342-6327. Anyone wishing to speak on an item must click the raise hand icon in the Zoom app or by dialing star 9 if they're participating by phone. Next, I'll read the city's notice regarding lobbyist registration. If you're appearing on behalf of a business, a corporation, or another person, you need to register as a lobbyist with the city clerk's office. If you haven't registered yet, you should register before you speak to the board. You don't have to register as a lobbyist if you're speaking only on behalf of yourself and not any other party, or if you're testifying as an expert witness, providing only scientific, technical, or other specialized information or testimony in this public meeting, or if you're appearing as a representative of a neighborhood association without any compensation or reimbursement for your appearance, to express support of or opposition to any item. Expert witnesses and representatives of neighborhood associations shall, prior to appearing, disclose in writing to the city clerk their name, address, and the principal on whose behalf they're communicating. If you're an architect, attorney, or employee representing an applicant or an objector, you must register as a lobbyist. These rules apply whether you're appearing in favor of or against an item, or encouraging or arguing against its passage, defeat, modification, or continuance. Lastly, I'd like to swear in any members of the public and any members of staff who will be testifying today. Please raise your right hands. Do you swear that the testimony you'll give in this proceeding is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. I typically would have discussion items at the end of the meeting to let applicants go first, but we had a request from the city to start with the special event permits. So, oh, great, you're here. So the city's going to present, and then we can have a discussion.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members, Lisa Garcia-Arrogante, Director of Tourism and Culture, Miami Beach. We oversee two divisions, the Special Events Division that does film, Special Event Permitting, and the Cultural Affairs Division that does all our grants and art in public places. We are here today, and I'm also joined by my colleague, Assistant Director Francis Vallecillo, who oversees the Special Events Division. We've been invited here today, and we're happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Michelle?
Okay. When I originally wanted this item to be up for discussion, the scope that I was thinking of was you have, in a residential district, a residential area, you see it a lot over Art Basel, you see it over weekends where people will request these special event permits to have parties being run out of their homes. They plan for weeks leading up to it. It's clogging up the streets, and these parties go on for hours and hours. So I don't know if you're ready to discuss this now. Maybe it's something we discuss later. But do you have an idea as to, A, kind of what the restrictions are, why we allow it? These parties really do significantly impair the quality of life for everyone else that's living around them. So
sure. And can you clarify? You said near your home. So you're saying are these house parties in your neighborhood? So
yeah.
We do not permit in
And then they go to them and then they say, oh, well, the city allowed it. It's, we're getting a permit from the city.
No, we don't permit in residential neighborhoods. We only do in public spaces or, hotels, but not in a residential neighborhood. Those are
so these house parties that are thrown over Art Basel. Again, I only brought up because people came to me, especially around Art Basel time, these huge events that they're throwing where they're going on until 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. They have these loading trucks that are taking up the streets. It's just not – the city could come and shut it down.
And they do. If I may, Francis Vice, U.S. Assistant Director. And that
Like Lisette was saying, that is an easy answer. We don't issue permits for residential. The only permit that we do is film. And we have had cases where a company, under the guise of doing a film activation or something inside of a home, and it did happen during Art Basel, extended it, and it ended up being a house party. I don't remember the exact address, but we did get wind of it. We send code, and we act on it immediately. But we do not issue special event permits in residential areas.
I think your only exception may be the Temple House, right?
But that is a business, so that's
right. Right.
But it's also we don't permit the Temple House because everything that they have is indoors. If they were to extend outside of their footprint, let's say they want to close the street to do something outside, then that would trigger a special event permit, right away permit, different things like that.
So the only special event permits that are given in a residential area might be for a film.
Well, it's not a special event permit. It's a film permit.
A film permit. Mm-hmm. But no special event permits are given in residential areas. They're only given in commercial districts.
That's correct. Well, let me clarify. Maybe not. It may be in a something. Sometimes they do it in a park, something like that, but not in a home. We don't give it to residences. We don't permit residences.
Great. Right. I'm assuming what you're talking about is someone just has a party.
Yeah.
No, but I mean,
disruptive, then code would be the.
Just a party. I mean, they have my.
No, I get what you're saying, but I'm assuming if what they're saying is accurate, which I trust it is, that people are just throwing these big parties, and the mechanism for enforcement, I'm assuming, would be code, right?
Yes, and we have had instances where it goes beyond just a regular party because they are promoting it. Their intent is to sell tickets, and obviously that's not a birthday party or anything of the like. Right. And yes, we absolutely get code involved, and it gets shut down, and sometimes PD is involved because...
And in this specific instance, and again, the residents were really upset because there were, I think, off-duty Miami Beach police that were actually in front of the party. They were the ones who were, you know, arranging and organizing everything. So.
And again, it is up to code visits, and they determine. And if it is maybe just a regular family party that is just very grand, and they're not selling tickets, or
this was a branded event from a very well-known company over Art Basel.
Sure.
Has that been explored with the city to be looking into residential permits for special events? Because I know we deal with that too in the Venetian, where we have these houses that are used during, you know, and it's one thing for people to have one or two parties a year, but when you're having regular parties where the homes, there's valet service and you don't have much recourse other than waiting for the after hours to do a noise complaint. Or if the cars are parked on the street, you can have some violations for the parking enforcement. But in between that, there's nothing. And again, most of the neighbors are okay with it happening once in a while. It's when it's like a reoccurring event at the same house month after month. And so has the city explored perhaps a residential sort of permit where people would be limited to one or two events a year?
No, we have not. That's not in our guidelines.
I'd rather keep it at no events per
right,
year.
Right, we do.
Well, the permit.
Because there's not much we can do in these residential neighborhoods when we deal with that.
Well, I would say, and we had an issue where I was speaking with Rogelio and with Hernan Cardeno about this notion of we can't do anything about noise disruption in our homes until it's after hours. But my understanding of the law, and Rogelio, please correct me if I'm mistaken, is that if you are at home and there is noise at any time of day, I mean, I used to live in your neighborhood in Bayshore, and the house behind me, I'd be working at my desk and my windows would literally be vibrating because I worked from home. And you can still call code because if you're in your home and your windows are vibrating from the noise and your whole desk is like... That's breaking the law. And so it's not that you have to wait until 11 o'clock. You just have to have your neighbors turn the music down. So I just want to make sure that code, you know, and Hernan and I spoke about it, that some of the compliance officers didn't quite understand exactly how the law is written. And they were under the illusion also that you had to wait until a certain time before you could call your concerns in. So just for anybody listening who has an issue, feel free to call code, and you know the worst that'll happen will be that they'll say, "Oop, there's nothing we can do about that." But there usually is something that can be done, and also people who are doing things that they're not supposed to be doing are very quick to tell you that they are sanctioned by the city. on my island, a couple doors down, somebody was running an illegal jet ski operation. And so when Code went out to investigate, they said, no, 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 we're doing this because we're storing, get this, we're storing the jet skis that have been taken from illegal jet ski operations for the city. That was their excuse. I mean, that was props for creativity. But clearly, that's not a thing. But I was curious, in addition to the particular house parties, which we know turn up at special times of the year, and, you know, they do get quite out of hand sometimes. And a couple years ago, there's a big one where somebody got murdered, I think. I forget what the deal was. But I was also hoping that you could just give a very brief overview of, because you guys do cover so many different things, what the process is for getting a special events permit, when neighbors have to be notified, when the rest of the city staff has to be notified. And I'm thinking about just this couple weeks ago, or this past weekend, it's a blur, but there was a special event that was sanctioned by the city, the Kiwanis program that was over the weekend with the art fair. But people on Ocean Drive didn't know about it until about a week, maybe, before it happened. And so can you just talk about that a little bit? There was concern about the way tents were set up and blocking cameras and, you know, can you just talk about the process in the ideal sense?
Yeah, take us through from when someone applies to how you determine.
Sure. And if there are extenuating circumstances where exceptions can or should be made, just so we can all sort of understand.
To educate us how it all works.
No, and thank you for the opportunity. Very quickly, to go back to two points that you mentioned for the noise ordinance, we do include in our special event permits language that says that our permits do not override that. So we make it very clear and bold and capitalize and everything. We also include language that the permit has to be on site for inspection by city staff. So you're always welcome to, if there is any issue that you think is happening, of course, call Code or anything, and it can quickly be verified whether it is a permitted event. So to give you a grand scale view, and of course, if you have any specific questions, we have an online process similar to all the other permits that our city has, an online application. When the person applies, we get notified, and then we immediately start the process of communicating with the applicant. And depending on the scope.
I'll interrupt you 1 second. Sure. Is there a time frame in which they have to apply prior to the event?
Yes. Okay. So it is 90 days for public areas, and then 30 to 60 days on private area, because it depends on what type of event it is. Sometimes it's just a restaurant that wants to add a DJ because they don't have entertainment on their BTR. So it depends. It may be a small activation that maybe it's just a DJ, so it's limited. Of course, the more notice, the better, because we can vet it properly. So we immediately go into communicating with the applicant, letting them know all the requirements. It can range from the certificate of insurance, indemnifying the city. We have different documents that they have to submit, a run of basics, or run of show, just to let us know what is happening, a site plan to let us know what area is being proposed, and then we start the vetting. So we work very, very collaboratively with our different departments, which include fire, police, parking, sanitation, environmental, and it runs the gamut. And we share all of the information with them via email. And in addition to that, we have a monthly internal review meeting where we get all these wonderful people together to discuss the events. And they provide us feedback. So we basically are a liaison between the applicant and the different departments and getting all the information that they need.
Just a quick question as you go through the process. Is there ever a time where you guys, your staff, meets with the applicants in person versus all email or phone conversations?
We have at times met in person.
That's not a requirement?
It's not a requirement. We speak on the phone. We speak virtually. Now a lot of meetings happen virtually.
And if I may, we do over 450 permits a year. Mm-hmm. So just to give you the scope, it would be very difficult to have in-person meetings with every applicant.
It may be something to consider that events over a certain scale would require at least one in-person, because even with the fabulousness of Zoom, which has made things better for a lot of reasons, there is something to be said for sitting across the desk and pointing at things and saying, this is where we're going to do that, because things, the best intended plans can sometimes, you know, have consequences that nobody thought of until everyone's looking at it and say, wait a minute, that looks great on paper, but, oh, I just had an idea. And that is something that, you know, could be something worth considering.
Sure, and if I may clarify, with the large-scale events like our Basel, we meet with them about 6 times a year. Air and Sea Show, all the large-scale events, South Beach Wine and Food, all the big large-scale events, we do meet in person.
But there's a big difference between a restaurant having a DJ for a private event one night because it's not in their BTR, and Art Basel. And clearly those guys require, I'm surprised you do it only 6 times. That's impressive. No, not in a denigrating way. I'm like, that's very efficient of you guys. That's great. But for the sort of in-between things that might be just a weekend that's not a 2 or 3 blocks long of a city, but that aren't as small as a restaurant opening for one night, like there might be a mid-range where it could benefit everybody involved to have one in-person meeting. And I don't know how you split up the categories of what the types of special events are.
Thank you for your suggestion.
Just out of curiosity, when there's an event like Air and Sea or Food and Wine, which are great events, but there are these tents out on the beach, who is it? I mean, there's no venue affiliated with the application, right? Like, is there a venue that applies? Like, Food and Wine has the big tents behind the Ritz every year. Is there an applicant that's tied to a venue? Or it's simply asking to use the public?
There is an applicant that does the permitting process on behalf of FIU and specifically for wine and food.
Got it. So it doesn't have to be tied to an entity. An operator of an event can just ask to have a tent on the public beach, and that goes through the same process. Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay.
And the private applicant, once they are able to secure that permit, what does that essentially entitle them to? What does that permit allow them to do? Is it just blow the doors off? You don't have to adhere to hours or any type of noise or decibel levels. You know, because
and I guess to put your point, are they tailored? Are they custom tailored each permit?
Yes.
Okay, so I think that's what Joe's asking.
Based on what they have applied for and based on the feedback from city services, not everything goes through easily. You know, sometimes we have input from police and fire as to safety and security, so we take that into consideration. Sometimes they want to reserve more spaces than the parking department will allow. So it gets tailored down to really what city services ultimately recommends. And to continue on the process, and I'll go back to when it finally gets to the permit, we also have a community review meeting every month. It's the third Thursday of the month. It is publicly noticed through the city clerk's office. In addition to that, that meeting allows the producers to be online, get feedback again from city services, get feedback from any community member that joins. It's a publicly noticed meeting. And we have regular attendees, which we have a great collaboration, such as representatives from ODA, So Be Safe, the Washington Bid, and I don't want to say right now exactly who all the ones are because I can't remember off the top of my list. Those are the common ones because we have a lot of activations on Ocean Drive. We are working to ensure that more notice goes out for these meetings because the input that we receive is valuable.
Right. And it's open to the public, so even if you're not a member of ODA but you live on Ocean Drive for whatever reason, you know, you can pop in and say, hey.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And the representatives that are on there and have provided input is based on the comments and the concerns that they receive, and it gets shared with us. And we've seen that the events receive it well, and they adjust as needed. In addition to those meetings, then, you know, we go through all the final collection of documents. If it is on the beachfront, sometimes it requires state permits to be out on the beach, more restrictions obviously during sea turtle season. So it obviously depends on the event, the scope, how much space they're taking up. And then when the permit gets finalized, it is tailored to that event. There are specific hours that based on what they submitted, based on what was approved, it states the dates, the hours, the location, and again, it does stipulate that it does not override any sort of noise ordinance at all.
So let me ask you an interesting question. If you isolated your department, is there anything in the process that you think should be tweaked or would be tweaked, but you're not getting cooperation from other departments, or you feel like it's all a good process and working well?
We feel very lucky that everybody works with us. It is a very fast-paced working department. We don't really stick to the 5 o'clock because they are events. So we pride ourselves in going above and beyond, and we are very lucky that we have representatives in each department that dedicate time to this, because we're grateful for the events that choose to be in Miami Beach, and we try to strike a balance with making sure that they're successful and maintaining the quality of life for our residents and our visitors, and we couldn't do that without the departments.
Right, so you're pleased with the process, no glitch. Okay. Gail, any questions? Joe, any?
I had a couple of questions and one recommendation. You said there's 450 special events permits? Oh, okay, that's a lot. Okay.
No, but that also includes, keep in mind, a ceremony. Someone's getting married on the beach. You know, it's not all large-scale events.
Okay. So do you check, well, I was wondering, is it standard operating procedure for your department to review beforehand the conditional use permits, the design review board orders, the board of adjustment orders? These are things that are like buried somewhere in the city website or in the planning department file cabinet. Are you able to retrieve these orders that might say this venue is not allowed to have any special permit? Special events.
Absolutely. And I think to Francis's point, part of the internal review meetings that we do with our colleagues is to discuss those type of measures.
Okay, so you have a review with the planning department.
Almost every department is in our internal meetings.
Okay, that's good news. That's very good. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm more concerned with, like, the neighborhood. You guys really did a good job, like, reaching out to certain people when 1212 Lincoln has their weddings on the parking garage. There's the fifth floor of the parking garage. But there's constant noise complaints from that neighborhood, those condos that are on Lincoln Road. Maybe they shouldn't be allowed to have any special permits anymore because there's so many noise complaints. Is there any consideration for that? And I know you only can reach out to certain people if you have certain people's email addresses. So this was my recommendation. To make it actually posted, you know, we have those pink signs that we put out when a venue is going to the planning board. Maybe those pink signs should also be posted. Maybe not the big events on Ocean Drive, because everybody knows that Art Basel or the Food and Wine Festival is coming. But like 1212 Lincoln, or if a little restaurant's going to have like a DJ and people don't expect like a live band to be playing next to their home, then maybe those little pink notices with a stick in them should be, since you do have at least 30 days, sometimes you give notice from the applicant, maybe it's possible to do that.
Thank you for your suggestion. We can definitely look into something like that.
Or building on Gail's suggestion, actually popping a note into the mailboxes of, you know, the residents within 350-foot radius. And it doesn't have to be a big, huge, glossy anything, just, you know, half a page of printer paper in English on one side, Spanish on the other side, because so often people live in a home where they're the renters, or, you know, it's their grandparents and their grandparents are on the email, whatever. But, you know, emails don't always, even if you have their emails, don't always reach the people who are impacted. So nobody wants to waste paper, but sometimes that is the old original, the OG style of reaching out to people can sometimes be the most cost effective and efficient.
No, and thank you for that. And our office, depending on, again, going back to depending on the scope, we do have different levels of notification. Sometimes it's a sign off if it's something right next to it, depending if it's something small, but there's something right next to it, a condo or a business, whatever it is, the adjacent property would get the sign off. If it's something larger, we do wide communication through our communications department, get the word out. But I will let you know that Commissioner Fernandez did put an item recently, and we are looking into something similar to what you were talking about.
You know, it's funny because we're also used to proceeding under our existing operating standards and SOP, right? Like standard operating procedure, it's how we do it, and it's worked. And sometimes we forget. I know at Converse we had this conversation all the time when I was like, why can't we do it this way? And it's, well, this is how we've always done it because that's what's worked. But what we sometimes forget is that the conditions have changed, not conditions as in conditional use permit, but things have evolved, right? So, for instance, the 1111 space, the garage that you're talking about, has a history of noise issues. But what we have learned in the last few years is that there's now pretty efficient and inexpensive and flexible and portable sound barrier technology where you can have panels around the perimeter that would baffle the sound or put flooring down that would help muffle the sound. And so maybe it's not all the way to ending them, but it part of their permitting process is making sure that that is a step that they take into account. And so, you know, 5-10 years ago, that might not have been easy to do, inexpensive, or even reasonable for the city to make that part of the conditional use or the permit process, but now it's totally reasonable. So, you know, it'd be interesting with all your free time, and again, having been in event marketing myself, I feel your pain. It's like the 4 o'clock a.m. phone calls, super fun. But at some point, on your summer vacation or whatever, you might take a look through, you know, what is standard operating procedure, and then kind of think about how that meshes with what we've just learned on the ground over the last 5 or 10 years with bigger events, smaller events, like, ooh, that's a good idea. Maybe we can make that process wide. Again, I don't know when you'd find the time. Maybe it's having an intern come in who's, like, super into hospitality and event planning and all that stuff and say, okay, here's what's on the books. Here's what we know from having lived in the city for the last 10 years. Give us your best guess. Like, how would you improve this?
Sure. And one area I think that probably goes along that process is environmental. Everything that we have in our permits, that's something that over, you know, 10 years or 15 years is probably not the same as it was now. So
right.
That's like just one area.
It'd be super, I mean, no glass on the beach, that's a no-brainer. But now, instead of plastic cups, it should be all, everything should be bamboo or recyclable or something. Like 10 years ago, bamboo cups, what are you, nuts? But now everyone's doing it and just codifying the stuff that we think about so that we have the best outcomes. How is it different when the city staff is negotiating and bringing an event to the residents of Miami Beach? So, you know, Commissioner Fernandez is working on something for 2024, I think, or 25 with the Goodwood Speed.
It's the Goodwood Festival
right.
Speed.
So does that go through the same exact process, or is that a little bit different? Or the art festival that was just here 2 weeks ago or a week ago, whenever it was. Again, same process or slightly different because it's being handled directly by an elected official or by a staff. So, and not to suggest that things are getting slid in, because that's not what I'm suggesting. Just like, is it just fast-tracked? Is it a different set of procedures? Is it exactly the same? I just have no idea.
It's actually even more encompassing. They're okay. Actually here from London upstairs. That's where I came from. We've been in negotiations with the Goodwood Festival since, I would say, the summer, almost a year. We've been in discussions. So they're coming for 2025. So similar to our proposal, these are discussions that take many, many months to discuss their footprint, all the elements, how it impacts different city services. So it's, nothing is fast-tracked because it touches almost, as we've mentioned, every department, and it impacts our residents and quality of life. So just to clarify, it's even more
rigorous.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I have to correct something. I said 1212 Lincoln noise complaints. I meant 1111
yes, Lincoln.
You
know who you are.
Thank you, Tanya. You know what I meant. I just thought of something when Tanya was talking. You said that the permits have to be on site. Well, that could be another thing, that the permit should be posted. You know, when my building gets a violation from code compliance, they slap this big sticker on our front door. And also when we did our concrete restoration, the permit for the concrete restoration is posted by the city on our front door of our building. Maybe the permits for these special events, you know, not for the food and wine, you know, on Ocean Drive, but inside a neighborhood, if there's a special event at a restaurant, or it should be posted like on their door or something. So just to make it easier, so if people lie and say, yes, I have permission for this, no, they do not because they're not posting their permit. So I thought, is that sound good or is that sound difficult to do?
I don't think it sounds difficult at all.
Okay.
Yeah, these are just recommendations, yeah, and you all do with them as you may.
Well, I have one more question for Nick.
Sure, go
just
ahead.
To get the lowdown, Nick, because we keep mentioning the noise ordinance. And for some reason, I read in the Mooney Code, actually, I thought the noise ordinance actually doesn't kick in until a certain hour, like 11 p.m., and then you can call, or am I wrong?
No, the noise ordinance applies 24 hours a day. What the code provides is after 11 o'clock, noise that's plainly audible from a distance of 100 or 150 feet, 100 feet is a per se violation. So the standard is a little different after 11 o'clock,
right.
But the noise ordinance applies 24 hours a day.
What is the noise ordinance before 11 o'clock?
Before 11 o'clock, it's unnecessarily or unusually loud or excessively loud. And there's a list of examples. Like, for instance, you know, construction during certain hours is considered to be unreasonably loud. The use of
it says, music can't be played louder than a volume that is necessary for the convenient hearing of the person or persons who are in the room, vehicle, or chamber in which such machine or device is operated and who are voluntarily listeners there too. So in other words, it needs to be at a reasonable level before 11 o'clock.
I mean, right. By that standard, if we were enforcing that, there are a million businesses. Right.
Let me interrupt one second. We're getting off on a tangent. I'm going to let them go. Unless anyone has any other questions, I wanted to allot a half an hour, and we're there.
Thanks, everybody.
Questions for them?
Thank you so much
for your time.
Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I just didn't want to keep them while we're talking about the noise ordinance.
No, it's totally fine. It just, you know, you walk down Washington Avenue, you've got the pizza place on the corner that's blasting music out that is far beyond the purview of the perimeter of their outdoor seating. I mean, you can hear it two blocks away, and you know, on Lincoln Road, you've got people doing that at every single restaurant. So, if people wanted to get really spicy about it, they could say all of these people have to turn their music down, not off, but if we wanted to sort of change the tenor of what people think Miami Beach is, instead of like running a gauntlet of noise coming at you when you're just running errands. Again, don't stop having fun, don't not have the music, but it doesn't need to be so loud that it blasts out your neighbor's music, which you shouldn't be able to hear anyhow. But yep, that's a different conversation for a different day.
Okay, we're going to move on to progress reports. The first is Planning Board File 210446, 90-day progress report from Mila Restaurant on page 13 of your packages.
Okay, so this is a 90-day progress report. The Planning Board originally approved the CUP. Their final approval of the CUP was on January 25th, 2022, which allowed for a second-story expansion of the Mila restaurant, which is located at 800 Lincoln Road. Prior to that, they had an approval which only allowed them to operate on the third floor. So this was the expansion to the second floor that's triggering this progress report. They received their certificate of use in November of 2022. They got their BTR December of 2022, and so now here we are for that progress report. As of the writing of the report, we haven't seen any violations issued. There was a written warning notice issued to the establishment December 17, 2022. That was shortly after the second floor began operating. There haven't been any recent violations. So given there haven't been recent complaints, recent violations, staff recommends the Planning Board discuss the progress report and conclude the progress report. That's it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, honorable board members. Welcome to the new board members. James Rao with Greenspoon Martyr with offices at 600 Brickell Avenue here on behalf of Mila. On this progress report, as Rogelio indicated, your professional staff has noted there are no open violations. There have been no violations issued since the amendment of the CUP. And at this time, the venue's in compliance with the conditional use permit and operating well. They haven't had any problems or complaints.
I was wondering, can we just summarize exactly what they're allowed to do during the conditional use permit? I have in my notes, you're allowed 669 occupancy, outdoor alcohol to 2 a.m., outdoor bar counter to midnight, and entertainment indoor until 4 a.m. Is that basically what – I want to know what I'm
that sounds correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that correct?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say I've actually been to that venue to check and didn't stay long inside. But outside, I was very pleased that they have a battery of people making sure that everyone outside was behaving, because I actually had them shush a drunk patron who was getting in a car. So, you know, my own observation is that it's been great. I'm glad they have no complaints. So kudos to your client.
Thank you.
Anything else, or people want to move this? Oh, I'm sorry. Is there anyone from the public on this item?
No hands are raised.
Okay. Anyone in the chambers?
No, I also was going by there the other day, and it was, I don't know, like maybe 10 o'clock in the evening, and there were folks getting out of a couple of cars to go in, and they were all like looking a little bit nervous and adjusting their outfits. They were young, so it was not like they go there for dinner every weekend or whatever. They're probably in their very early 20s, but they were like making sure everything was just the way it was supposed to. They were very well behaved and...
Not
causing a ruckus in any way, shape, or form.
And I know there were some people on the board nervous about, you know, what we did. But, again, kudos, because when I was there, I was amazed how many people they had employed outside on the sidewalk making sure there was order. So please convey that to your client that I was very happy to see that.
Absolutely. And they've been very pleased with their food operation there as well, the restaurant.
Okay. Motion to conclude the progress report.
Second.
All in favor? Oh, I guess, do we have to do it? Can we do by affirmation?
That can be a voice vote.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Seconder of the motion? Okay.
Jonathan.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay. Next is Planning Board File 200339. Same type of 90-day status report for the Paris Theater Queen. Mr. Massa, okay. Were you sworn in?
Yes.
Okay.
No,
okay.
Can you raise your right hand? And anyone else who has not been sworn in? Do you swear that the testimony you'll give in this proceeding is the truth, all truth, and nothing but the truth? Thank you.
Okay, so this is a progress report for Queen, located at 550 Washington Avenue. It's for the Paris Theater. The Planning Board approved a modification to the conditional use permit for the Paris Theater on June 23rd, 2020. That modification requires that that the applicant appear before the Planning Board for a progress report within 90 days of the issuance of the BTR. We did sound testing with the applicant on January 23rd, 2023. It's a fully enclosed space, so there was no sound escaping from the facility. They received their certificate of use on January 26, 2023, and they received their BTR on January 23rd, 2023, and I believe they began operating that following week. So this is a progress report, a 90-day progress report for that establishment now that they're operating. The applicant also let us know they would like to replace the ownership entity on the CUP. Currently, it's 550 Landlord LLC, and they want to replace that with the operating entity, which is 550 Washington LLC. They've indicated that the ownership is actually the same for both entities, so there's really no substantive difference. The conditional use permit does indicate that the board reserves the right to modify the conditional use approval at the time of a progress report in a non-substantive manner. Because it's the same ownership and operating entity, this is a non-substantive change, so we have no objection to the modification. We haven't seen any code violations. There were four noise complaints made between February 10th and February 19th. However, no violations were observed by code compliance officers, and there haven't been any complaints since then. That was probably in their first weeks of operating. They may have had some issues, but it seems like they have those under control now. So with that, the staff recommends that the Planning Board discuss the progress report, approve the modification of the change of the ownership entity, and conclude the progress report.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Mickey Marrero here on behalf of the Paris Theater,
Queen, and it's Principal Matthew Moss is here with me. As to the second point that Rogelio mentioned, again, what happened was when we applied for the planning board order in 2020, the only entity was 550 Landlord, which is the owner, which Mr. Massa owns. The operator entity, which is, and I have, if anyone cares to see it, they're both owned entirely by Massa Investment Group, the exact same ownership, but for business purposes and operational purposes, the 550 Washington is the operator entity. So we spoke to Rogelio and Tom, and there seems to be no issue making that change, but you all just need to approve it. As to the noise complaints, and again, no violations, but Mr. Massa was very proactive anyway. We identified where they were coming from. And again, this is a fully enclosed use with a very long vestibule that takes you from the street to the actual use. But we did determine that all the complaints came from one Airbnb unit in the commercial building just north of us. So what Mr. Massa's team did, even though they weren't violations and just complaints, they installed two additional sound panels on that side of the building. Since then, there have been no complaints. So the code officers came and determined there was no issue, but nevertheless, to avoid any potential future concerns, he addressed it right away, and we've had zero complaints since that was done. So again, we certainly agree with staff's position, and we'd like to make that change on the ownership and move on. But if you all have any questions, Matthew's here, and I'm here to answer them.
So I would like to commend you for being proactive in addressing the noise violation. I mean, it seems like today is a noise topic of conversation at the planning board, but it just, you know, we've wrestled on this board with our neighbors and businesses on how to make sure businesses can do what they need to do, provide a great service, make some money, and enrich our collective cultural experience with, you know, people have to sleep or work or get their babies to nap or, you know, whatever. So for you to just go do the right thing without being forced into it, thank you, and I would like to hold you up to the universe to show how easy it can be to do the right thing. And props to you, and I hope people out there who are trying to open their own businesses or expand take this as a lesson because it's great.
Yeah.
And Mickey, thank you for explaining the that was going to be my first question, but okay. No need. Thank you.
And I just want to echo, I know Mr. Massa for many years, and he operates a lot of venues here, and you're a first-class operator. Your place is phenomenal. I've been there multiple times, and it's an amazing addition to Miami Beach. And when you get on Washington Avenue to go in, you don't hear a peep. So I was thrilled with everything you're doing, so congratulations.
Thank you. Unless there's anything further, I'd make a motion.
Gail, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I had a question. Well, I did an on-site visit. I ate there. It is drop-dead gorgeous. It's like, wow, this is like the most gorgeous place in Miami Beach. So thank you for building such a beautiful place. I got to say, I had a really good time there. I saw Michael Larkin there, too, when I was there. So I wanted to understand just a little bit better for my own, you know, for us going into the future. Why was there noise being heard to the north? Is it your wall touches the wall of somebody's apartment? Or I don't think you have windows on the north side. And my other question was, maybe it was in the alleyway. Is there ingress, egress from the alley?
It was related to the fire exit doors. They were not properly isolating the sound, so we actually installed some panels inside and some framing to prevent this from happening. And the complaints were coming from the building right next door to the north, yes.
Is there an alley, like, and between, is there a corridor between your building and the other building?
Yes, there is.
Are they touching? Oh, there's...
There is.
Okay, I understand now. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll echo the comments that were said. I've been multiple times. Fantastic venue. Breathtaking. And you can tell it was quite an investment. And for that, we thank you, because you took a big chance on Miami Beach, and you seem like the type of operator that we would like to attract to our city, because this wasn't in any way involved with the crowds or clientele that had issues over the weekend. This is the type of venue that we want to elevate. I wanted to say the same to the operator that was here before with Mila. These are new venues that we should look to promote Miami Beach, do things the right way. So,
and by the way, I don't know if people know this, but it's one of the first venues in a long time that has a dress code. And they've raised the bar to much more elegant. The whole thing is just amazing. So, again...
I actually was very proud last week, during this difficult time that the city is going through, how many well-dressed up people showed up and went through the hassle of going through the traffic, even though they were like 45 to an hour late, they still came and enjoyed their time and went home. And that gave me self-confidence that what we built is attractive to a certain amount of people. And the location, even though it was challenging, as you all know, now is a proof that this can be done. And I was approached by many property owners in Washington Avenue that actually want to elevate their properties. And there is a lot of investors now that have the self-confidence to do more. So I already know a lot more is coming on Washington Avenue, and I think this is great because this is one of the avenues in the city that can do better, and it's already happening as we go. So I'm very proud of being the first one to initiate that, and that I get the support from the high-end clientele that showed up the past 2 weeks.
You know, I would like to say one more thing. I'm sorry I'm going on today, but I sit in the historic planning chair of the planning board. I'm on the board of the Miami Design Preservation League, and it is not lost on me that one of the things that makes your establishment so unique and so special, and that you can have a dress code and that people fight through traffic and show up an hour late and still want to be there and you still want them to be there, is that you took a falling apart theater that had been left to decay and adaptively reused it. And you know, people are like, oh, Tanya, she's so anti-development, and I'm not. I'm anti-egregious development. I'm very in favor of smart, resourceful, thoughtful, character of place, considerate development, and again, shining example. I mean, it gives you a point of difference as a business owner and operator. It gives your clients an opportunity to feel the glamour of what had been. You're not recreating it. It's not like recreating it at Epcot Center and feeling like, oh, I've been to France because I had French food at Epcot. Like, please, c'est pas vrai. So, again, more of that, please. And Washington Avenue is something that I've, you know, you touched on it, and I just want to reiterate. That is could be the backbone of our cultural corridor from all the way south of 5th, all the way up, basically running all the way up into North Beach, although obviously Washington doesn't go into North Beach, but you continue along all the way. But there are so many cultural attractions on Washington, so many beautiful spaces that have been left to sort of fend for themselves that can be elevated. And I'm thrilled to hear that you're hearing from, I guess, Troy and other business owners that there are more things like this coming down the pike. That is exactly what we need to bring our beloved city back to its heyday. Doesn't mean that they're all super expensive, fancy places with dress codes, but they're all unique and interesting and harken back to what made us special in the first place and what continues to make us special and differentiate us from Vegas or Sunny Isles or any place. So, again, props.
Thank you. Melissa, thank you very much.
You're good. Everyone else? Okay, you want to move it? Oh, public comment?
No hands raised.
Michael Larkin, are you going to? All right, someone want to move
I'll
it?
I'll move it.
Okay, move.
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Mr. Musk.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I apologize. I missed the second on that. That was Tanya made the motion. Okay, Mr.
Fuller. Jonathan.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Okay, previously continued items. Planning Board File 220560, 801 South Point Drive, Gaia Restaurant.
This item is they fill an application requesting a condition.
Get closer to your mic. Sorry, I can't really hear you. Is it on?
They requested a conditional use permit for a neighborhood impact establishment for a restaurant located at two of the existing ground floor commercial spaces in this building. On our last meeting, they requested a continuance just to submit revised plans.
Okay, so as stated, they requested a contingency. They have since submitted revised floor plans that addressed several of staff's concerns at the last meeting and revised the way the ground floor looks. So you'll see on the ground floor plans that you have that you had before, it included a kitchen facing the street. Now they have actual more active spaces facing the street, restaurant seating facing the street. They do still have a gourmet kitchen facing the street that actually makes it interesting and pretty for people to look at, and then their VIP area that actually looks out onto the street. So all of staff's concerns in terms of this, in terms of the floor plan, have been addressed. So this, by way of background, this is a restaurant with alcohol service. It's proposing to occupy two existing commercial spaces of the building. And then there's a restaurant in between these two commercial spaces, which is called Kosushi Miami. It's kind of in the middle of the two spaces, and then the two spaces are joined by a corridor towards the rear of the restaurant. They're proposing a restaurant with 237 seats and an occupancy load of 388 persons, and that includes 30 outdoor seats that are on a private terrace on the west side of the building facing South Point Drive. The applicant is not proposing any entertainment. This is in the south of Fifth neighborhood. There's no entertainment allowed. However, they still provided a sound study because they are going to have ambient music playing indoors. Not entertainment, no DJ, none of that. Their sound study did recommend several conditions in order to prevent issues with vertically adjacent dwelling units. So there are residential units right above the restaurant. So they proposed several conditions regarding soundproofing the structure in order to minimize the impacts to the residential building. We had the sound study peer-reviewed, and as a result of that, the applicant proffered a condition to not have any outdoor speakers. Staff agrees with that proffer. However, additionally, staff recommends that the outdoor hours of operation cease at 11 p.m. rather than midnight, as proposed by the applicant, in order to minimize sound related to people eating, dining, the noise, the talking that may affect the residents that are located immediately above the restaurant. Staff was also made aware by some public comment of some issues regarding the existing loading operations of the building, which is sometimes occurring on Washington Avenue, South Point Drive, Jefferson Avenue. This loading activity often blocks the public right-of-way and the bicycle lanes. In order to prevent issues, staff has recommended a condition which says deliveries must be conducted via designated loading zones or in loading areas on private property. No deliveries shall be made from undesignated loading areas on Alton Road, South Point Drive, Jefferson Avenue, or Washington Avenue. And additionally, at no time, delivery or service vehicles shall block any portion of the public right-of-way, including but not limited to bicycle lanes on Alton Road, South Point Drive, and the bus stop on Washington Avenue. We were also made aware of issues with the valet operations with the previous restaurant at the site. The valet operations sometimes block bicycle lanes on South Point Drive. So in order to address that condition, we've incorporated a condition in the draft order that says all valet parking operations shall be conducted within the rented on-street parking spaces for the valet ramp and shall not block at any time the bicycle lanes on South Point Drive. Additionally, we were made aware of issues with the public sidewalk. The public sidewalk in this location is narrow. They're locating their outdoor seating all entirely on private property. However, because of the narrowness of the sidewalk, we're recommending that outdoor seating area, including any planters, be set back 5 feet from the property line in order to provide a little more space for the public to be able to circulate through there. So with those recommended conditions, staff recommends that the application be approved and pursuant to the conditions in the draft order.
Thanks, Charlie. Before you start, Michael, any disclosures to make with communications with applicants or the public? Gail? Joe?
I spoke to Ron Starkman, who represents the Neighborhood Association, and he said they met with the applicant and they were okay with this.
Okay. Joe?
Just the email that we received from some of the public feedback.
Okay. Jonathan?
Yeah, I heard from Ron also providing his support.
Melissa?
No.
No. Okay. Thank you. Michael?
Sure. So good morning, Mr. Chairman, Board Member, Staff. Michael Larkin, 200 South Biscayne Boulevard. I just want to remark upon the dress code at Queen. It's a real thing. I went there very excited. The first weekend, I step up to the front door. The front doorman looks like me up and down like this. He's like, I'm like, what do you mean?
Me too.
He's like, where's your blazer? I'm like, come on.
I showed up in a polo shirt. He wouldn't let me in.
I was like, come on. I begged. I didn't represent Matthew Massa. I begged. And I got in, but it's a very real thing, and I'm so happy for him because he's a great guy. So good morning again, Mr. Chairman, Board Members, Michael Larkin, 200 South Biscayne Boulevard. Here with the applicant, Gaia Restaurants. It's an internationally renowned Greek Mediterranean restaurant. With me today is Jose Gomez, our architect. Steve Magnus is the owner's rep, appearing via Zoom. Alexei Polakoff is from ownership. Nicholas Rodriguez is here running the presentation. Adrian Dabowski from Kimley Horn is our traveling engineer via Zoom. And Andy Swordlow is our acoustical engineer from Criterion Acoustics, also via Zoom. So next slide. All right, pull it up in the first place. Then next slide. Okay. So GAIA has existing locations in Dubai. That was their first location, then Doha, Monte Carlo, and soon to open in London, hoping to establish their first North American location in Miami Beach in the South of Fifth neighborhood. Next slide. GAIA is known for going all out for their interior design. Many locations feature exclusive private dining areas or chef's tables. Next slide. This is the one in Doha. You can see the signature fish raw bar in the background. Next slide. Monte Carlo. Next slide. This will be London. This is the interior. Next slide. That's the exterior of the London location. Next slide. So as you all know, probably very familiar with Marea condo building located on South Point Drive on the western end of it. Next slide. So right now, this interior design, they're taking inspiration from all their other different locations. They're pulling it all here for this particular location. It's a unique unit because, as was pointed out, Koh Sushi is located in between both sides of this rented space, but they are going to make it work. Next slide. Sorry, go back one.
What's currently in this space?
Nothing.
It's been vacant?
It's been vacant for a while.
Okay. Sure, yeah.
Hold on. Can you go back to the CUP? Yeah. So go back to the CUP. Sure. So we're asking for the conditional use permit for NIE because the square footage is such and the aqua load is 388, so that puts us past the 299, so we're a neighborhood impact establishment, and we need a conditional use permit. We're requesting hours inside 11 a.m. to 2 a.m., outdoors until midnight. Staff is proposing to limit the outdoor area to 11 p.m., but that was before we voluntarily proffered to have no outdoor speakers. It's important to note that Red Steakhouse, just literally a few feet away, has outdoor seating, and they operate until midnight. And there's a regulation in place in the South of Fifth neighborhood that says any outdoor area must shut at midnight if you serve alcoholic beverages. So all we're asking for is one more hour to be treated just like the neighboring restaurant tenant just to the west of us, and then Call Me Gabby is just along Washington. So they're also open until midnight. So next slide. So we've reached out. We have the support of Marea Condominium Association. They want to see their commercial spaces activated. As Gail and Tanya pointed out, we met with Soft not once but twice to their executive board and then to the general membership. And we also met with Alex Hurst, the president of the Apogee Association, and he is fully supportive of our request. If anyone would be alarmed at the outdoor seating, it would be Apogee because they literally are 100 feet away on the south side of South Point Drive, yet he's in complete support. Next slide. So this is the, it can be confusing because Marea is a curving building, but as you see, like in the pinkish color, that is the leased space for GAIA. On the left-hand side would be Red Steakhouse, and then we wrap around Koh Sushi, which is right in the middle of our restaurant. Next slide. So we're proposing 237 seats. There'll be 30 outside, 207 inside. Next slide. So deliveries, we have no issue with the condition that was originally suggested by Matthew and now incorporated by staff. We think that's fine. There's an alley behind Marea. This is a public alley, but there's a portion of private property where loading will occur through the back of the restaurant. We agree to the condition that Rogelio just described to you all. Next slide. The valet operation, same thing. It can be in front. We'll at least have 10 attendants with a tech system for retrieving cars. Again, we have no issue with the condition that Rogelio described. Next slide. So this is what you'll see from South Point Drive. Again, it's a curving space, so they're able to really make it pop. Next slide. This is just another perspective of it. Next slide.
Michael, so quick question from right there. So your outdoor seating area, it's almost, to the naked eye, would look like it was almost commingled with red. They're both kind of in that center curving vestibule area?
Yeah, I mean, it is close to red, but not right on top of it. There is a space that will be in between.
But right where they have their outdoor seating.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, because that's the ideal location for them. You know, they really couldn't have it in another location, but it's on either side of that entrance, there'll be outdoor seating. Was that where we were, Nick?
We're right here at the corner.
Okay. So South Point Drive in Washington. Next slide. This is unique. You know, we Rogelio pushed very hard to get all the improvements away from the storefront window system. We agreed with him and gave us opportunity to do a pastry kitchen. That's what you see there. It'll be an active use right there. You can see from Washington. That's another perspective of it. It's hard to see, but the chef's, the private dining room is up to the right-hand side. This is up here, Washington Avenue, looking back towards South Point Drive. Next slide. So we have some modification to the conditions. First one is 6AI. In an older floor plan, we had 370. In the most recent floor plan under your consideration today, it's 388. The next one is 6A sub 2, and that we're just asking to change the closing time for the outdoor seating area, go from 11 p.m. to midnight again.
Michael, I'm sorry. Can I slow down a second? Can you go back to 6A? What's the change?
So it's condition 6A,
right?
Little I, right?
Okay.
So, and it's up on the screen too, but we would like to go from 370 to 388. That's that modification request.
Okay.
Okay, now going to the second one. The second request is condition 6A little 2. So here we're asking that the closing time for the outdoor seating area not be 11 p.m., but be midnight. We feel comfortable making this request because we have the support of all the residential neighbors, whether it's Maria or...
Okay, so you've discussed that hour increase with them and yes. They're all supportive?
Right, correct.
Okay.
Correct. So that's the second change. The third change is that if we do want to make any modifications to the outside that might put improvements somewhat close to the storefront window system, we would like some flexibility not to have to go to the design review board right away, but give staff the discretion to approve it as well. It's just going through the public hearing process here can be somewhat burdensome. It's always a four-month time frame. And if staff feels they can approve it administratively, great. But if not, then we'll, of course, go to the DRB. So those are the three changes we like to the conditions. That's all I have. Nick and I are happy to answer any questions you all might have.
Thank you. Board?
I have questions.
Tanya?
Good morning. So morning it is. Good morning, everybody. So the kitchen being visible from Washington seems super awesome. So that means that anybody wandering past can, like, just stop and watch dessert being made.
Yeah.
But you're saying that if you guys want to make changes to that, you want the opportunity for it to be approved administratively, which takes away one of the cool features of what the approval process has been predicated on.
So,
or am I not understanding that?
Correct. Let me address that. So staff is very clear. They want, and the standard rule of thumb is basically 10 feet. You need to be 10 feet back from any storefront window system before you do any type of improvements. So staff would be naturally inclined not to accept any type of improvements that would be within that 10-foot zone. We're just saying if the improvement is innocuous enough, like, please let staff the opportunity to say, yes, and this is very minor, we can approve it. We don't always want to go to the DRB for
everything.
What
do you have in mind that could come down the pike? This is non-binding. This is not a trick question, but...
Can we put the presentation back up and we'll describe it? Nicholas Rodriguez for the record. So it's these arches in the windows. They're kind of signature to Gaia and the different locations, and they're just inserts on the inside of the window. Right now that may trigger a design review board application. We'd just like the opportunity to discuss that with staff. That's really
okay. So it's not that you're blocking the windows or putting seating in front of it or changing anything that would be operational. It's really just aesthetics.
Right. And I think seating would still be okay. Maybe not in the pastry kitchen area. It wouldn't make sense there. But, you see our floor plan, there's seating up against the windows and the other parts of the floor plan.
And so I had a question about that, too, because you're saying the private dining room is also visible from Washington?
Yes. Can you go back, Nick, and show that? So if you look at this carefully, if you look where the cursor is, that's where the...
This one you could
see. Yeah.
That's that. That's it.
So you think people are going to want to have a private event where people wandering by can take pictures?
I don't think they're going to be doing anything lewd and lascivious.
No, clearly not. But that's you guys. Okay. That's a business plan and operational issue. I'm not going to get involved with that. The sound question. So you guys are saying no music whatsoever outside.
It's great to have it, but it's better to be able to open to midnight.
Okay. And the adjacent properties that do have outdoor seating and operations, do they have music out there now, or is it just voice, just ambient?
Call Me Gabby does.
Yes, Call Me Gabby does. Red Steakhouse, I've been there a few times. I never, because we, yeah.
But so the reason I'm asking is, thank you for that. Yep. The reason I'm asking is because the configuration of the space is, you know, cheek to jowl with a residential tower. Call Me Gabby isn't. I think it's independent, right? It's its own little structure. So the reason I'm asking is because we've learned through the very good work being done on some other properties with outdoor, either entertainment or just outdoor noise, is that all of the sound can be mitigated from the street or coming across to whatever level it is, but what we haven't yet resolved in some other cases is how sound travels up, right? So if you're, you know, if it's a ground floor thing and it's lively and raucous, not raucous in a bad way, but everyone's having a great time and 100 people outside chit-chatting and drinking and telling funny stories creates a certain amount of noise. If you're living on the third or fourth or fifth floor, you're going to hear that still. So I'm not going to weigh in at this moment about 11 o'clock versus midnight, but I would suggest that there may be an opportunity to be proactive as you guys build this out and think about sound issues, because it might sound fine, no pun intended, from, you know, people walking past or whatever, but if you're overlooking that space in your apartment that you spent $1 billion for, and it's noisy, not excessively noisy necessarily, like nobody's having huge parties, but noise does travel upwards, and there's nothing to block that sound from traveling. So,
well, a couple things. You know, there's only 30 seats outside, and I agree with you, noise does travel. But also remember that we're not asking to relax the noise regulations. Mm-hmm. At 11 p.m., no noise can be plainly audible 100 feet from your property line. Now, it's a little bit unusual, because what is your property line? How does that relate, you know, when you go vertically up? But I think code compliance have no issue issuing a notice of violation if noise is plainly audible in the unit of someone that's above.
I just think, you know, as we've seen with other folks today and previously, acting preemptively to keep a problem from happening goes a long way. And so if there are, you know, if you can put planters or stuff with overhanging foliage and bougainvillea, which might help muffle the sound a little bit, or I don't know what the solution is, but I'm not saying it's a condition of anything. I'm just saying to think about it proactively.
Nick just gave a good idea that whether it's umbrellas or maybe a canopy, that would require more of interaction with the condo association. But then you underneath that,
that just keeps it
noise absorption materials you can adhere to underneath that.
Yep. So give him a raise.
Nick. He deserves that. Of course.
I'm going to get other board comments, but I always think it's beneficial to hear the public before we question. Is there anyone wanting to speak?
We have no hands raised.
None? Okay, no. Great. Close up. Anyone in the chambers? No. Okay. Go ahead. Gail?
I don't know, when staff recommends, you know, limiting an hour of operation, I tend to agree with them. I mean, this is an unusual situation. Almost every restaurant that we opine on has a hotel above it or an office above it. I don't remember us ever having residential units right above a restaurant. The other reason, I mean, I think they should close at 11 p.m. and also not have outdoor speakers, because they are right next to Red, who can have speakers. Is that what we said? Red has speakers?
I don't think they do.
No, I don't think they do. Because it would be very awkward to hear somebody else's music and hear this. You know, it happens all the time when I'm Lincoln Road. I'm having dinner on Lincoln Road. I hear my restaurant speaker and the speaker of the restaurant next door. And it's so uncomfortable. Like, I'm eating my meal. It's not like I can just get up and leave.
They're not asking for speakers, though.
Well, they're saying they want speakers till 11, or they want no speakers till midnight. Is that what you're saying?
It's not disjunctive. We're saying flat out no outdoor speakers at
no,
all.
No, they took the speakers away.
Okay, whether it's 11 or midnight?
Yeah, they're just no speakers.
Okay, they prefer to be up until midnight.
So thank you very much for that.
Music.
Well, maybe we could do a compromise. Maybe, you know, midnight on Friday and Saturday night and 11 o'clock the rest of the week. That's my thought.
A couple questions, and maybe for staff. In the surrounding neighborhood, what is the standard? I know Call Me Gabby was mentioned, but how about the block of restaurants on First Street where there's Poppy Steak because there's residential above it, but also, more importantly, residential right across with the Cosmopolitan and the Quartz. So what is that standard? And if it's not midnight, why are we deviating?
Well, doesn't Poppy Steak not have an outdoor?
There's no outdoor.
There's no outdoor.
That strip there, because there's other restaurants along that strip with outdoors.
So it's true that there is a standard for South of Fifth that they have to, everybody has to close by midnight their outdoor areas. So that's generally the standard. Here, because it's a conditional use permit, you have residents right above. We think it's a different situation than what we typically see in the South of Fifth neighborhood. And so we recommend that closing an hour earlier just to prevent issues with the residents above.
Okay. And did the residential buildings, I know the Apogee and Maria, did they actually comment on the operating hours that they preferred? I know they were generally supportive, but
we haven't received any comments, but we can look at what he's shown us.
We did reach out to them and we raised staff's condition each time because it's harmful. And whether it's Maria, Sofna, or Apogee, they're all in support of midnight because of the small number of seats outside.
Okay. And I also agree with Tanya. I had that written down here, some sort of natural sound barrier, one perhaps in between the terrace here where the seating is and the street because that would help with the Apogee, maybe some sort of decorative wall, and then a canopy or something like that to prevent noise from traveling upwards. Again, a question for staff. I keep seeing it pop up. It's mentioned in here that they have VIP dining and a private club. So perhaps applicable to this, even if they don't have plans to operate past 2 a.m. If, let's say, in South of Fifth area, there is a 2 a.m. rollback to venues with seats above 100. I've also read in the alcohol ordinance that there could be a carve-out for a private club. What would constitute that? That a private club would essentially be able to, private membership club would be able to serve alcohol and essentially not be.
No, the private club language in the code would yield to a stricter alcohol hours of sale rule for a specific zoning district. So in South of Fifth, prospectively, The last call is 2 o'clock. That 2 o'clock would apply to any private club that was also an alcoholic beverage establishment.
Okay, appreciated. I
believe that there are certain grandfathered establishments that can remain open until 5. Anybody new is 2 a.m. So they have a 2 a.m. cutoff as since they're a new establishment.
Yeah. And then the last thing I'll make. I know the gentleman that owns the retail. Blockage here. I think he has 2 or 3 other assemblages in the area. Maybe it would just be good to get his grander vision because, you know, the concepts all seem kind of similar where it's not boring dining but not a story nightclub. So that area could look pretty different 2 years from now. So maybe it would just be good to get a sense for what his general vision is instead of piecemealing this all together.
He was trying to raise his hand. He was texting me that.
What's that?
Robert Rivani.
And that's all I have.
Oh, I see the hand raised now.
Is he the owner?
Yeah, he's okay. The owner of the space.
Okay.
Can we allow Robert Rivani to speak?
And Robert, before you speak, do you swear that the testimony you'll give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. How are you? Thank you for taking the time on this hearing. I believe the comment has come up about the overall grander vision of South Point. I in fact on the ground floor of Maria, the One Ocean building, and where Continuum restaurant space is as well, where Catch is going. I would want to first opine on the specific location. We have spent a extremely lengthy amount of time talking to the local community, the residents, the building, Maria, Apogee, and all the neighbors, and we have unfettered support from every single one of them. For the longest period of time, this block had been looked upon as an eyesore because it had vacancies all across the board or uses that the community were not in support of. The kinds of restaurant tours that are coming to this area, whether it is, you know, Gaia that we're mentioning today or Catch or Philippe Child that's going into One Ocean, are, you know, top-tier Class A tenants that are not going to be bringing a ruckus or a noise or outdoor drinking and being something against what the community wants. Gaia are people becoming in gowns and very high-end outfits and a classy venue. So when we explain this all to the residents of Morea, they're excited for it. They don't want a vacant space for, you know, since it's been built, I think, in 2013 or 14. They want a class A operator that draws the right kind of crowd and people here. And the noise was talked to them about, you know, it's the same thing at Carbone or Call Me Gabby. They already have. Red State has till 12, but I don't think any of them have really been fined or have much issues because at the end of the day, we're not putting speakers and blaring music and having anything along those lines that would affect, you know, the sleeping patterns of people or the normal ability to live a happy life at nighttime. So I'm happy to answer any specific questions, but I just wanted to push the fact that we have, in fact, spoken to SOFNA, all the buildings around, and we've gotten letters of support from every single one of them, not only on the uses, but as well as the hours of operation and being open till 12 o'clock on the outdoor patio areas.
Thank you. And I was going to say that, Gil, your point is well taken, but since all of the associations you've met with are okay with 12, I'm okay with that and see what happens. That, to me, is important, and I appreciate you reaching out to all the residents.
I have a question for staff. If in 10 years the restaurant and the owner decides they're done, they're moving to Fiji and pulling up stakes, and somebody else comes in, the new somebody else would have to go through this whole process anyhow, right? So the rights granted under the CUP would not transfer in any way, shape, or form.
They would be able to transfer them. They would have to submit an affidavit to the city saying that they would agree, that they agree to abide by all the conditions of the CUP, and then they would have to schedule a progress report to come to the planning board within 60 days of submitting that application, just to let the board know, hey, we're here, we're new, and let the board.
Right, a change of ownership always entitles us to amend the CUP, right?
It'll be a progress report, so you can amend it in a non-substantive manner. But if you would like to amend it further, we could schedule a modification hearing at the progress report and bring them back.
So okay, because that's what I'm trying to get at. I'm often inclined to go with your recommendation and say shut it down at 11. But because the community has said it's okay for midnight. It seems like who are we to tell the community what they should have if they think that midnight is okay? There are different circumstances because it is adjacent to a building, literally, as opposed to standing alone. So I would like you guys to come back once you're open, you know, to make sure that it's working the way everybody planned. But also that if there is a change in ownership, that would be something, you know, because if it goes from being a super high-end restaurant to being a super high-end nightclub, and everything's inside except for this little smoking area outside. Mm-hmm. That's a different thing.
So you want us to come back to a public hearing for a change of ownership, which is, I think, okay with us, because to staff's credit, they're just trying to streamline the process.
Right.
And say, just submit an affidavit.
Right, and streamlining, I mean, who doesn't want streamlining? But we've seen where, in the best intended efforts at streamlining, things have gotten approved that probably wouldn't have been had they been aired out, because what happens is you have people hashing things out together, and that is the best possible way to find, oh, we didn't think of that. That's a great idea. Or, oh, you know, this is something we don't even need, so take that out, right?
So look, if you want to have that additional layer of protection in exchange for having us be till midnight for the outdoor scene, I think that's a fair compromise.
And then having you guys upon opening back in 2 months just to make sure there are no...
60 days is fine.
And Tanya, I think that could be a modification to condition 2, to say, which is the change of ownership condition, that that any change of ownership or 50% or more of the stock interest shall require a modification to the CUP.
That's what I would suggest to my colleagues.
But that maybe will never happen, a change of ownership. What if?
But that's why they're coming back in 2 months once they're open, to make sure that that there's no unintended consequences. And the neighborhoods have all said midnight is fine.
So if we approve this, they will come back to us?
In 2 months upon opening.
90 days or 60?
90 days.
We have in condition 190 days, if you'd like.
90 is good, because then we get a better. Yeah. Okay, I'll agree to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'll just say to the community, if this isn't working, please reach out to us. You don't have to go through the applicant or lawyers. Please reach out to us if it's not working.
Great. Someone want to move it?
I'll move it.
Okay. Tanya moved it. Second.
Are you accepting the other modifications?
No, with the modifications.
Yeah, with the modifications.
If you could just read this back so we make sure we've got them all.
Do you, by any chance, do you have a paper copy of your...
We'll email it to you within minutes.
But so what I have is condition 6A, Roman numeral 1, change the occupancy from 370 to 388. Condition 6A, Roman numeral 4A, to add to that, that they can make include changes with the approval of the design review board or staff, or can be approved by staff in accordance with the design review criteria. And then I have...
Wait a minute. That 4A says something about window treatments. Right. Oh, that's it? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So we had incorporated a condition that if they want to cover the windows with any sort of a treatment or decorative panels, that had to go to the design review board. They're suggesting that in addition to that, that staff have the ability to approve it administratively subject to the design review criteria.
6A2, about the hours.
Oh, and then 6A2 for 11 a.m. to go to midnight for the outdoor seating areas.
With the progress report.
Right.
In 90 it's days.
90 days.
And the change to condition 2 to require a... modification to the CUP in the event of a change in ownership.
And so coming back here for a hearing.
Right.
So 2 is going to say 90 days instead of 60 days? Is that what it is?
No, the progress report is in condition 1, and that already says 90 days.
Right. They'll be back 90 days after operations.
Condition 2 was the thing where we were just talking about if they sell and it turns into a nightclub instead of a restaurant, that's not an administrative change. It comes before the planning board.
Okay. And when are you guys going to open? Approximately?
What do you think? Give a date. 1 year? 1 year from today's date.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Oh, you're such an optimist. Have you ever built anything in Miami
just
before?
Just to clarify, it cannot be a nightclub because it's south of 5th.
Right. No entertainment.
No, I know, but it just...
An example.
Who knows what?
Just I don't want anybody to think we're going to allow nightclubs.
No. Okay, so it becomes a debate club where people get really upset about their particular sides and their warm-up room is outside. And okay.
All right, Nick, call the vote, please.
Okay, so we have a motion by Ms. Spott.
Yes, Shield seconded.
Second by Mr. Cement. Roll call, Ms. Beattie.
Yes.
Ms. Spott.
Yes.
Mr. Cement.
Yes.
Ms. Durham.
Yes.
Mr. Elias.
Yes.
Mr. Frieden.
Yes.
Mr. Magazine.
Yes.
Motion passes.
Great. Thank you all very much.
Remember, thank you guys.
Wear a blazer to Queen.
anything else from the board?
I'm going to tell them I know Mr. Larkin.
we have one more discussion.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. We have a discussion item on parking. My bad.
And we did order lunch. I'm hopeful
it'll be lunch to go. Okay, so the next discussion item and last discussion is underutilized parking. Is there anyone presenting from the city? No, right?
I'll be discussing the item. Yeah. On January 24th, the planning board was discussing an ordinance related to parking requirements for existing restaurants in parking district number 6. That's Alton Road. That was an ordinance related to the restaurant Macchialina that was looking to expand. And as part of that discussion, the board requested that we schedule a discussion item for underutilized parking. So for the purposes of that discussion, and I provided a report that includes the definitions that we use that are relevant for underutilized parking, surplus parking, off-site parking facilities, and such. So I'll just start going through those. So we have in chapter, section 133.36, talks about surplus and underutilized parking spaces. So surplus spaces are when a building has more parking than what is required by the uses within the building. Those spaces become surplus. Those spaces can be utilized for required parking by a use that's not on that property consistent with the requirements of the code. And so the code has different criteria for when you can have your parking located off-site. So if you're in a historic district or in the South Beach Architectural District, you can have your parking within 1,200 feet of your site. If you're not in a historic district, you can have the parking within 500 feet of the site. If you're south of 5th, you can have the parking within 1,500 feet of the site. And that parking can be located north of 5th. So that's the basically the 5th and Alton garage accommodates a lot of the required parking for some of the uses in the south of 5th neighborhood. And then we have another condition for properties located north Normandy Drive that have a lot area greater than 30,000 square feet, which are individually designated a historic site. They can have the parking within 2,500 feet. That's essentially that was done when they were looking to restore the International Inn and designate the International Inn as a historic site. So the International Inn can have their parking within 2,500 feet. So if you comply with that criteria and there's a building that has surplus parking, you can provide a lease or a covenant showing that you're going to be providing your required parking in that building. It doesn't happen often that a building has surplus parking. They typically have what they need. And then we have another standard, which is called underutilized parking. Underutilized parking is when you have required spaces. So they're spaces that are required for the use, but they're not used during parts of the day, or for whatever reason, the parking requirement is higher than what you actually need, which happens frequently. You can submit a request to the city and provide a report and have those spaces declared underutilized. And generally that happens for valet parking storage. So if you have a bank, the bank uses their parking, let's say from 9 to 5, then the bank closes, those spaces are empty. A valet operator could utilize those spaces using the underutilized program. However, those spaces cannot be considered required parking for another use. So Maquilina, for example, if they, let's say they had to comply with the parking requirement, there's a bank on Alton Road a couple blocks up. That bank's parking spaces are not utilized at night. They can use that for operational valet parking, but that cannot be their required parking for the use.
And why is that? Like, if Maquilina entered into a legal agreement with the bank and said, we have access to this from 6 to midnight, whatever, and here it is in black and white, why? I'm sure there was a reason why this was drafted, but things have changed, so mm-hmm. Why is that still not an acceptable use?
It's just not in the code. I'm not saying that it's not. From a planning perspective, that's actually a good idea. Yeah.
It could be reviewed. It maybe should be reviewed to see if that addresses some of the concern.
So and then the next thing that I have in the report is the shared parking requirements. So this is utilized for one site, but it could potentially be utilized for uses off-site. So when you have a building, let's say you have a building that has an office, a bank, and residential. Those uses have their peak parking demands at different hours. So we have a table in the code that you can reduce your parking requirement for each of those uses based on a shared use ratio. So you can see in the report there's a table, and that table is in the parking code, which tells you when different uses utilize their parking. So banks are utilizing their office, their parking, 100% weekdays between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., whereas retail is only using 60% of their parking. Hotels are only using 50% of their parking during those hours. Restaurants only use 50%. Theaters only use 10%. Nightclubs use 5%. So we do the math of which of these results in the highest parking requirement and let you reduce your overall parking requirement by that difference. I don't know if I explained that well. So we would do the parking requirement for each of the uses, then we would do the parking requirements using this ratio, and then you would be able to reduce your parking requirement by the difference of the ratio to what's in here.
But that shared parking is for a development, a single development with
Correct.
Mixed use. So it wouldn't apply to the Maquilina situation because they're not related to each
Correct.
Other.
Correct.
So I definitely totally understand the Maquilina situation. So then my question is, for example, Gaia that we just discussed, they're going to be using the neighboring residential building. Are they required to have designated 24-hour spaces for the valet at that condo where they're going to be parking?
They're required to have spaces. That does not say that the valet has to use those spaces. The valet could be an operator that has their own spaces somewhere else. But the restaurant is required to have spaces in that building.
Right. And so, so does the restaurant have spaces in their own building? In the, because I know there's a parking garage attached to it. Or are there spaces only going to be, or do they have they secured the spaces in the neighboring condo?
I know the restaurant, the building has spaces for the restaurant. I'm not sure how their actual valet operator will function, if they will be using those spaces or other spaces, and just simply allow the spaces in their garage for self-parking.
Yeah. Okay. So for me, one of the reasons that I thought we were discussing is for the situation like Maculina to, you know, forget the guy is not a good example because they have parking spaces in their building also. But to figure out a way to encourage spaces, you know, good operators like Maculina to not have to secure 24-hour spaces in nearby buildings. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I think this board should consider, is when you have a use that's only one time a day, you know, starting at 5 p.m., mm-hmm. you know, for dinner only, to allow them to utilize parking, off-site parking, not necessarily 24 hours, but just for during operating hours in a building like the Baptist Hospital or the bank parking lot or whatever it may be. And so that would be a recommendation that I think we should make to the commission to tweak or modify the ordinance.
Yeah.
I'd second that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's like it's taking the shared parking and codifying it, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we talked about other things that just sort of have always been the way they've been and now things are evolving, this, and we just went through the whole resiliency code where things are being cleaned up. I don't think this was addressed in, so this could be the first thing that we bring forward to the new resiliency code as
well,
a way.
Well, there's already going to be amendments next month.
Okay. All right, so it'll be the 101st. I should have known better. Whatever. Girl can dream. But my point is that this is a great example of conditions in the city having evolved from where they have been and how laws were written. I mean, if we could make this shared parking thing chart something that people could take advantage of quite easily, you know, appropriately, not, you know, trying to get something on the fly. But then the other thing that as I was listening to you talk about underutilized and surplus parking and all this stuff, we also have this issue where new development from scratch is coming online, right? And so the developer wants to make something that is attractive and to neighbors and residents, and that is attractive to potential investors and buyers. And having an 8-story parking pedestal does not accomplish those things, right? So then the developer gets the commission to waive the parking requirement, and then at public cost, public subsidy, a public parking structure is built close by so that the developer can then provide the parking that they are required to off-site in a not-yet-existing facility. And I'm thinking specifically, I'm sure there may be other examples that you guys can think of, but the two 20-story buildings coming online in North Beach both need, if I recall correctly, and if I'm wrong, please correct me, but my understanding is they both need a certain amount of public of parking for their residents. They're micro units, they're short-term rentals. I don't know how that complicates the math here. But the way they were designed, the parking is not on site, right?
Most of the buildings in North Beach do have
the two new ones that are being built now.
They have parking garages in their plans. Yeah.
But to cover the entirety of what they need?
They cover the residential portion. Retail in that area has never required parking, so the retail components don't have required parking, except for the Target is providing their own parking because Target wants parking. But generally, the retail restaurant components of those buildings don't have required parking, but the residential components do.
Okay, so the two 20-story towers, say that 10 times fast, that are coming online, one is two-thirds built and the other one, I think, just broke ground, do have their residential parking requirements covered within the footprint of their building.
Correct.
You're 100% sure.
Their parking requirement is reduced, what's required, but they do comply, and they do have parking.
Okay, so reduced how and why?
We're encouraging people to walk as much as possible, so if you build it, they will come. If you
give them parking.
Okay,
but they do have parking.
Is there one parking spot required for every unit in the buildings that Tanya's speaking about? Because if it's one parking spot for every three apartment units, then that's not – I get her point then. Yeah.
Because that's – you know.
I only recall this from a news article, but on the Next Miami, it says 72nd and Park plan to include 270 residential units with a 326-space parking garage.
Okay, so that's reason. That's
because I'd heard that as well. So when I saw this article, I was that's different than what I've heard.
Will you send that to me? Yeah. But then in those buildings, there are also residential units and then STR units that are not fully residential, right? I thought there was something where they weren't going to have enough parking for everybody who would likely need it, even though we're all hoping that eventually we will transition away from the automobile and into different modalities. And so that was part of the reason why it was so important to build a parking structure on the surface lot a block away to accommodate the additional.
Maybe Ocean Terrace doesn't have parking.
No, they definitely do. They have a whole pedestal. Anyhow, so that's what I was trying to understand, is that
I think the parking garage is intended more to support the retail of the area than the actual residential uses.
Interesting, because that doesn't hold water to me, because during the day that lot is empty. The surface lot is empty. It gets full for special events and on beach days sometimes, not even always, but during the day for retail, it is underutilized. But all right, different conversation for another day. Okay.
I wanted to point something out. We keep mentioning that we were initiating this for Maculina Restaurant, but I want to remind you that Maculina owners specifically told us that they would not even use the parking, any parking, if they have to pay anybody for the parking. They don't want to use a valet, and they don't want to pay, let's say, Baptist Garage across the street for use for their required parking. So this is not going to help Maculina, whatever we decide today.
I think Maculina, that ordinance is already.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before. I think we're
so
just using them as an example.
Okay. And the second thing I wanted to just mention is, you know, maybe we should restrict who can use the suggestion that we're going to make. Like a cannabis dispensary cannot use this privilege.
We do have in the code, we specifically say that medical cannabis dispensaries have to provide their parking on site. They cannot take advantage of having their parking off site. The thought back then when we did it, so that if you're going to get marijuana, you're not walking through a neighborhood to get your marijuana, you just drive.
But then how come the bodega on 16th Street, which is a nightclub, applied for and received a building permit for a cannabis, even though they have no on-site parking? I thought they were going to use the parking garage 1212 Lincoln to fulfill that requirement.
I'm not aware of a dispensary at that location.
Well, it doesn't exist. They applied for a building permit for a dispensary.
What was the address again?
1220 16th Street. It's called the Bodega Taco Stand / Nightclub.
It's really a one-stop shop. You go drink and dance, get your weed, get the munchies, and then eat.
It might be CBD or something, but it's not a medical cannabis dispensary. That's not something we would approve.
Okay, so I saw that they had a building permit for it. I was wondering where they were going to get their parking. So they can't use across the street.
Yeah, that cannot be a medical cannabis.
Okay, I just also wanted to make sure that this item that we're going to recommend, it's never used at residential parking garages. It's, apartment buildings, condo buildings, hotels. I want to make sure that the required parking at apartment buildings cannot ever be considered underutilized parking. I'm thinking of the Flamingo Point. There's 1,800 people that live there. There's like 2,000 parking spaces. A lot of them are not used because people have to actually pay $200 a month to use a parking space. But it would be a terrible thing to use that parking garage for venues, let's say on Alton Road, then you know how much traffic's going to be going through the residential neighborhood, going in and out. I don't know. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, you don't want to have unintended consequences to a residential neighborhood.
Yeah, so I don't know how to really word it to make sure when we make our motion that what we're suggesting cannot be used at apartment buildings or hotels.
Well, I think that it would still be subject to traffic studies or whatever if it's going to have that much of an impact on the neighborhood. If there's that many seats at the restaurant and they're going to provide valet parking, I would imagine if it's enough seats to make an impact on, you know, the West Avenue area, then there's going to be a traffic study of some sort.
Yeah, if you're doing valet, you have to have a plan submitted to where you're going to park.
But the thing that does, you know, come to mind is there needs to be some, and I guess the first step is sort of directing staff to explore this, right? So, and exploring an ordinance and drafting an ordinance, a potential ordinance, because one of the things is if you are building a new restaurant and we say, okay, you allow, you know, we'll allow you not to have on-site parking if you utilize, you know, you're only serving dinner, you utilize the Baptist, you know, health center's parking lot. But they get into a contract with Baptist for 2 years. Baptist decides they don't want to keep doing it because it's a disaster for them. Then you have a situation where there's no parking for the restaurant. And so there needs to be some sort of safeguard to make sure that there is a solution, you know, a permanent solution for it.
And perhaps to Gail's point, is there a way where we could limit the utilization of the shared spaces to when you're sharing with to a commercial usage, to her point, so it's not that the Waverly says, okay, we have 15 extra spots because it's summertime and some of our residents are gone. Can we, can Maculina park there? So limit the usages to existing commercial spaces or surface parking lots or something along those lines.
I don't feel strongly about this, but I can see situations where Flamingo or the Waverly, if they have, say, 50 open spaces, right, a restaurant needs 30 spaces, that might be able, if the restaurant is so successful and their valet is so successful, that might be able to pay for the residents' spaces so that they don't have to pay that $200 a month. The residents might be saying, we would love them to come and use these empty spaces because then that pays for our building's valet for the whole year just from, you know, at night. And then that's, you know, their maintenance fees could be reduced. You know, some of these buildings south of Fifth that have restaurants on the bottom, I mean, that's huge money for the building. Their maintenance fees are extremely low. So I can see situations where it would actually benefit residents, but your point is well taken that, you know, obviously traffic in residential areas is a consideration.
Well, a hedge fund owns the Flamingo, so they would benefit. They would get the money, not the residents that live there. So I'm just asking, you know, when you guys do make a draft ordinance, to just, you know, we just pay consultants a gob of money to update our ordinances because they're so confusing and complicated, you know, that you would make this really clean and very not complicated so everyone would understand the language.
So the shared parking ratio, if you look at it, residential is not listed as one of the uses that we consider for a reduction. Even though there are other cities that do utilize it because generally residential has lower utilization rates during the day as people go to work, so those spaces tend to open up. So if you have an office building nearby, a bank, for example, could use those spaces during the day, then residents, when they get home at night, can use those spaces. But our ordinance, as it is today, does not take into account any reductions for residential. It's just for commercial types of uses. So what I'm gathering is the thought here is, right now, the shared parking is only allowed for a single site that has multiple types of commercial uses, that you would want us to consider opening that up where it could be utilized for uses off-site.
And be used as required parking.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, for off-site, for required parking. And now we have requirements for how far you can be to have your off-site parking. Would you suggest any changes to that, or are you okay with the way that's drafted? Because we have
I don't know the pros and cons of the distances. You name there's three different distances: 500 feet, 1500 feet.
Right. So in a historic district, it's 1200 feet, with the idea being that the garages are a little more sparse. In a non-historic district, it's 500 feet.
I don't see the need to go into that. But I guess the issue with the shared parking is that they don't need to be secured 24-hour spaces, just like, you know, evening spaces for like a restaurant or
right.
for a condo or whatever maybe.
Yeah, so what we would do is we would run the ratio. We would look at the uses in the building where the garage is located, and then we would throw the use that's located off-site into the mix to see how that reduces the parking requirement and determine if that garage has sufficient parking to accommodate the required parking with the reduction of the use that is off-site. That's how I would kind of see it working.
And could you also, Rogelio, provide an example, a solid example of an existing parking garage? Maybe we should take the Baptist. It has, I don't know, 300 parking spaces. And then if this draft ordinance was approved, like how many parking spaces would open up to allow for the next door neighbors to use it? Thank you.
Okay.
So does it make sense for you guys to draft something and then we look at it again with
sure.
all of your...
Yeah, we can give you some ideas. Yeah, I would do an update to this memo with some thoughts.
Yeah, that would be great, because we cover a lot of ground here, and it seems like you guys synthesizing it and making it usable, user-friendly would be helpful.
Rahul, you remind me, do we allow public comment on discussion items?
It's up to the chair. It's not required.
Is there anyone that happens to be? Okay, I was just curious.
Pretty much everybody's gone offline.
Okay.
See some city staff on. So I would next month's agenda is going to be pretty long. So if we wanted to continue it, I would suggest that we and to give us a little time to May, if you don't mind.
Yeah, let's do that for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything else? All right, board. Thanks for another great meeting.
Right. Hopefully, lunch will arrive.